This is Law and Disorder.
If you're Black or Latino in New York City, you have an 84% chance of being stopped by the NYPD on the street.
This has gone on for years. And finally, or hopefully, community activism coupled with a lawsuit by the Center for Constitutional Rights may change this horrific practice.
We'll talk with award-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges about his new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle.
If you believe Chris Hedges, and I think you should, most Americans are chained into Plato's cave, watching the shadows, not even of reality, but the shadows of an illusion. Hear more why Chris Hedges thinks imperialism and democracy are incompatible.
Stay with us. We'd like to welcome WHUS 91.7, the University of Connecticut, as our new affiliate. We appreciate your picking up our show and supporting independent media. Michael, what's the latest news on John Brown's farm?
Well, they're closing it down. It's another chapter in the United States of amnesia. Brown's farm is up in the Adirondacks in North Elba, right near Lake Placid. It's where he organized the raid on Harper's Ferry. It's where he's buried. His wife is buried. His daughters, a number of people that participated in the raid. It's one of the most beautiful places and one of the most important places in terms of Black history and in terms of the struggle for equality in this country. They're closing it down. You can protest this by writing Assemblymember Teresa Sayward, 940 Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12248, or State Senator Betty Little, Room 506, Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, 12247. They're not going to make the decision until April. If we mobilize now and yell and scream, we'll keep the place open. Can you imagine they're closing John Brown's farm?
What do they want to do with it?
They just don't want to spend the money to keep it open to the public.
Outrageous. Michael, what's happening with the Mamilla Cemetery petition to the United Nations?
It was served on the United Nations. It's an extremely strong document. You can get it on our website, lawanddisorder.org. The news of the Israelis, in conjunction with the Simon Wiesenthal Museum, building a museum on top of an ancient Arab cemetery and calling it the Museum of Tolerance, echoed around the world. The story is getting legs. This is something we can win. Lawanddisorder.org. Get a hold of our website and protest this, really more than a desecration, really a symbol of the dispossession of the Palestinian people and their humiliation.
In the beginning of 2009, statistics show that 84% of the people who were stopped and frisked by the New York City Police Department were Black or Hispanic. Very few of these stops, however, yielded any contraband or weapons. Critics say the stops are racially oriented harassment. Not everyone stopped by police, however, is frisked. About 59.4% of all Hispanics stopped were also frisked. The New York City Police Department insists that these stops help fight crime. The Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a class action lawsuit against the city and against the police department over these stops. We are now joined by Center for Constitutional Rights staff attorney Sunita Patel and a plaintiff in the case and Bronx resident David Floyd. David Floyd and Sunita Patel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
David, we'll start first by asking you to give us some background on this case, Floyd versus NYPD.
Right. It's named after you, right, David?
It is. Well, basically, the cases surrounding illegal stops and frisks, particularly in Black and Latino communities. My role as one of the plaintiffs in the case is essentially that, for me, a couple of times over the course of the past few years, I've been stopped in my community, illegally frisked, really given no real opportunity to defend myself, right?
And when you say illegally, mm-hmm. meaning the police didn't have what we call probable cause to stop you, you weren't doing anything that they saw as, quote,
no.
suspicious.
No, I wasn't. Going about my everyday life.
Where do you live?
Literally.
What neighborhood did you live in, David?
Parkchester in the Bronx.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us what happened.
There are two different incidents that are a part of this case. And literally both times I was going about my daily life. I work, I go to school, I'm on the pre-med track. So, you know, I'm constantly, of course, trying to better myself. And I was stopped both particular times, once when I was heading home, once when I was leaving home. The second time was actually on the premises where I live. Basically, both times the same things happened. They went into, they searched me illegally without probable cause.
Well, just ostensibly looking for contraband. Did they say anything to you?
The first time they didn't say anything to me. They did what they were going to do, and they tried to leave. Fortunately, I asked for their names and badge numbers before they left. The second time that I was stopped, towards the end of the interaction, they told me that there had been a number of robberies in the neighborhood, which, you know, if you speak to most young black males in particular, they'll tell you that when they get stopped, it's either they fit the profile or, you know, there's been some robbery in the area. Someone has called in and said, you know, such and such. It's a script that we found the police go by continually. And at the end of the day, we're the victims of it.
So I think the important thing to remember is that the United States Constitution requires that police officers have reasonable suspicion that there's a crime that's about to be committed in order to stop someone, and that there must be some suspicion that there is a danger or some harm to the police officer in order for them to frisk them, or some idea that there would be a weapon that the individual has. Unfortunately, what the statistics show that came out is that's not bearing fruit. There's been such a record number of people that are being stopped since the Center for Constitutional Rights case, Daniels versus City of New York, settled. There's been a 600% increase in the numbers of stops. And
what are the numbers, Sunita?
In 2005, there were 400,000 stops. This year, in 2009, the numbers that came out today say 575,304 people were stopped and questioned in 2009.
What percentage of them are black, white, Latino?
Blacks and Latinos, of that number, make up about 87% of the people that were stopped. That is about an 8% increase from the numbers in 2008, which were roughly 531,000.
Sunita, am I being overly suspicious, or are these people being stopped not because they're crime suspects, mm-hmm. but because they want to develop a police database on all of them?
Well, that's an interesting theory. I mean, we allege in our lawsuit that this shows a pattern and practice of the city to illegally stop and frisk and racially profile black and Latino communities and members of those communities. We also allege in our lawsuit that there's a failure to train and monitor and discipline police officers that goes all the way up.
Sunita, you mentioned the earlier case, Daniels. Didn't that involve the street crimes unit?
It did.
As a result of that, didn't CCR was monitoring the statistics of stop and frisks? Wasn't that part of the settlement?
As part of the settlement agreement, the city is required to provide us with statistics.
Exactly.
And to make them publicly available.
Right. Great. And when was this lawsuit filed?
Filed in 2008.
David, I want to go back to you for a second. Two of the incidents in this lawsuit are around really stop and frisks of yourself. What was your emotional reaction when this happened? I mean, how did it make you feel?
Right. It's funny. I often tell people that it's almost as if you're walking down the street and someone jumps up out of nowhere to rob you. Right? They go in your pockets, you know, they ask you what you got, they take your wallet, so forth, so on. But in this instance, and you don't know why it happened, it just happened. But in this instance, they come up to you, they go through your pockets and everything, and what they try to walk away with is your dignity. They try to see if they can in some way, shape, or form incite something from you to arrest you, essentially. So the experience in and of itself is somewhat of an embarrassing one. You definitely can feel demoralized, you know, if you're living, doing what you're supposed to be doing every day, not breaking the law.
What do you think would have happened had you said, don't touch me?
Well, that speaks to, you know, the other, I think, aspect of the stop and also of challenging, right? Because there is a real element of fear. Someone who's, you know, at least for me, bigger than me, usually bigger than me, with a weapon on them, is jumping up out of nowhere. There is, you know, a fear factor that's involved. But knowing the law helps. And I feel like there are ways to very calmly, very cool-headedly challenge and ask questions. But they don't like that. And I've, you know, in this situation as well as other ones and other people I've spoken to, when they do challenge in that way, there's usually some type of reprisal from the police.
You mean, that's been my experience.
You mean like they could charge you with resisting arrest or something like that?
They could beat you up.
Exactly.
They beat you up. Let's, maybe between you and Sunita, but if you wanted to say something, what's the legal response you could make, even if there might be reprisals?
Mm-hmm. I know for me, I always ask, again, very calmly, why is it that I'm being stopped? Do you have probable cause? I eventually get to the point of if it's not answered, I ask again. And I ask again. I also find it commonplace to ask for names and ID numbers, badge numbers. One of the things that you're supposed to say, especially when, you know, when you're being frisked, is that, you know, I do not consent to this search, which, as far as I understand it legally, is okay to say.
It's okay to say. The problem is like waving a red flag in front of a bull. Mm-hmm. You provoke these guys, you challenge their authority, and they come down on you. And inevitably, mm-hmm. that's what happens. I know Bruce Wright, who is a big champion of people's rights against cops like this, said they ought to give these guys a psychological test before they even let them on the force. Because mm-hmm. the kind of guys you get, you know, want to be provoked, you know, and then they go back to the suburbs at night. And these are the guys, when you challenge them, I really admire your courage for even asking them mm-hmm. why they're doing this or what their badge numbers are. I mean, it really takes courage to stand up to these guys when they're out there intimidating you like that.
I agree with that. Sunita, do you have any
Michael,
other thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Michael, you raise a really good point with, you know, what should folks do? What should community members do when they're being stopped by the police? And one of the things that we hear time and time again, from especially from young people, is that they do have fear and that they feel afraid of what the consequences would be. People in New York City have lived through the worst of the NYPD, and although the Street Crimes Unit has been disbanded, the practices seem to a certain degree to still persist. There's still police on civilian violence and murders that are happening throughout the city, and it's important to recognize that there is this historical memory of Amadou Diallo, of Abner Louima, and this colors people's perceptions with the New York Police Department, and the police department has done absolutely nothing to instill any sense of safety within Black and Latino communities.
We're speaking with attorney Sunita Patel from the Center for Constitutional Rights and her client David Floyd, who are suing the New York City Police Department for these frequent harassing stop and frisks in minority communities in New York. Sunita, what kind of relief do you want here? If you had your druthers, what would you like to see happen?
We would definitely like to see more accountability in the CCRB, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which is the body that is designated to hear civilian complaints regarding the New York Police Department. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work. The complaints go through the CCRB and then are filtered back to the police department for discipline. We think that the CCRB should be independent and have its own, whether it's prosecutorial or other enforcement powers. We're also seeking better oversight and monitoring through the CCRB and other avenues. We also think that there just has to be a change in the way that the police trains and puts out, especially rookie cops and undercover police officers that are flooding communities and really just stopping and frisking young people at a record number.
This has come up for you twice. Do you have friends where it's come up with as well? And is there some kind of community response to it?
Right. Unfortunately, I think this type of aggression in our community is all too commonplace to the point where it's accepted, unfortunately, particularly amongst Black men, right? Black and Latino men, I should say.
I mean, this is just part of being Black in that community.
Exactly. Exactly. This is what we live with. You know, you may not talk about it with someone, but you know that they've experienced it at least once in their lives. Once you do talk about the experiences, it's really not a surprising discussion. Is more so accepted, like, oh, you know, like, yeah, this happened.
You know, put together with what Sunita said about, you know, the examples, the historical memory of, not so historical, of Diallo and others, and I can tell you, if I had a kid in that community, I mean, my first reaction would be just do what they say and get the hell out of there. That would be my first reaction.
Right, right, which, you know, I mean, is what most people themselves want to do, right? So there's always that temptation to not assert yourself. To not let them know that you actually know what your rights are, to not challenge them. But part of, I feel like, our response as a community has to be to support young people, to support anyone and everyone who are getting stopped illegally and saying, you know, you should assert yourself. You should make sure that they know that you know your rights.
And I think that it's also important to point out that because this has reached such a record number, there is certainly the sense of, among the communities, of, well, how can we even bring change about when this system is so mammoth and the NYPD itself is thrown up so many brick walls. But there has been a growing organized response that organizations and grassroots community groups have been a part of, including the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and Make the Road by Walking in their Brooklyn office. And I think it's important to recognize that people are beginning to stand up and say, we need real reform and we need it now. This has to end.
David, Sunita, if our listeners want to get in touch with you and try to help you in this effort, do you have a website or a phone number anybody they could ask them to contact?
Yes, for more information on the Floyd versus City of New York case, you can go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website at www.ccrjustice.com/stopandfrisk.
And we'll put that up on lawanddisorder.org also. David?
Also, I definitely would support and encourage people to support and learn from the efforts of organizations like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who are going out and actually documenting incidents like these, police brutality, illegal stop and frisks. And so that type of community response is also necessary, I feel like. We have to support activists, those who are going out there, who are going out on the front lines and making challenges to state violence. I think that as a community, we have to document more. It used to be a thing where, well, not everyone has video cameras, not everyone has video cameras on them, but we have cell phones now with cameras. So we need to make sure that we document this constantly. I think that ultimately what we'd like to see happen is that community members become activists, right? So that eventually there's also an international voice that comes out. Right now, and this may be taking it, stretching a little too far, but the securities industry, to me, is benefiting from tactics that are being used against black people here in the United States. It's benefiting from tactics that are being used against Palestinians, Iraqis, Afghans. So people are profiting from these sorts of tactics.
Sunita, on the statistics, is there a related arrest rate to this high number of stop and frisks?
Well, what's interesting is that there is no correlation between the number of stops and frisks and the number of arrests. In 2009, we have said that there was 575, roughly 300,000 people stopped in 2009. Of those, only 6% were arrested. That's a very low rate. It was only 6%, which is a rough estimate of the number based on the statistics that have been released.
I mean, that just makes you crazy. I mean, how can that be? They're stopping over 500,000 people and arresting 30,000.
They're stopping. It seems like they're stopping everybody.
Yep.
Everybody, at least in certain communities and of a certain color or race.
It's important to recognize that while blacks and Latinos are subject to about 87% of the stops in 2009, they only make up about 50% of the population.
And the percentage of arrests of blacks and Latinos is even higher, right, than the 87%, is that right?
The 87% is number of stops.
Oh, okay, I got it.
And arrests, we actually don't have the breakdown of arrest by race because we haven't received the race statistics yet.
David, let me ask you a personal question, if I could. How did you get involved in this? How did you get political, and how did you eventually get involved with this lawsuit? I mean, what was it that brought you here into the studio?
Right. I had been doing community work around police brutality and police violence, state violence, previous to these incidents. I was definitely familiar with CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights. I had been part of a previous lawsuit when myself and two other activists were attacked in Brooklyn while conducting what we call Cop Watch, which is monitoring police activity. So I've been pretty involved in things, very aware of some of these statistics and definitely our experience as, as Black and Latino people, and as well with Center for Constitutional Rights.
How have you seen, if any, the changes in between the Giuliani administration and the Bloomberg administration on the issue of police stops? And then I guess Sunita maybe can help us with the statistics. But is there anything to say about that, or is it just continuity?
From my experience, and I came up here towards the end of Giuliani's administration, but from my experience, as well as speaking to other people, it's been pretty continuous. I think that the Bloomberg administration has been able to use tactics to cover things up a little bit more. And I think that, then versus now, we're in post 9/11 America. So there are a lot more things that are accepted and a lot more things that are swept under the rug. I think very recently, the admission of a number of former officers that CompStat numbers have been doctored.
What are CompStat numbers?
CompStat numbers are, as far as I understand, numbers, statistics about arrests, stops, things like that. So, as well as procedures that are being used. So the admission recently that many of these numbers were doctored and certain tactics were used for those ends, I think says a lot about the level of continuity between the Giuliani administration and this Bloomberg administration. And it's something that I feel like we have to follow up on. There needs to be definitely local inquiry into what happened. If state funds have flowed into the NYPD, which I'm sure they have, then there needs to be a state inquiry. If the state is implicated in some way, shape, or form, right? Or if we don't feel like they can be an independent body in this, then there needs to be a federal investigation. Because the NYPD has benefited internationally, again, from tours, things like that, and these tactics that they're pretty much exporting around the world.
I was going to ask about that. And this is for, I guess, both Sunita and you, whoever wants to answer. What happens in New York, and I've been here a long time, and I think it's, as you said, there's a huge continuity. There's been stops since I've been at school here that have been like this. But what do you see, how do you see this reflected, if you know, in other major cities in the U.S. with their policing? Is it similar to New York? Is it different? What is it?
I can tell you in all honesty, from what I've seen, again, have family all over the U.S., it's the same. The same things are happening. Again, I will say that the tactics here that are being used in this big city that are supposedly successful, right, what we think of as successful, what they think of as successful, are being exported into other cities. They're being exported into other communities. I think that there is the veil of accountability that comes, for instance, with the CCRB, right? So we think and we believe and we want to believe that there's more accountability here, whereas in other places, for instance, down south, there's much less, right? Because there aren't bodies like that. However, what we've experienced is that it's almost as if the CCRB doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's been a problem forever. And Sunita, let's go back to the lawsuit for a second. David Floyd, who we're speaking with, is the named plaintiff. Are there other plaintiffs, and what stage is the lawsuit at?
We have four named plaintiffs in this lawsuit that has been filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as with partnering law firms that I should just plug, Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman, and also Covington and Burling. The case right now is in discovery, which means that we are actively seeking more information from the City of New York about their practices of stop and frisk and around the policies, and also around the incidents that involved our particular named plaintiffs.
I wanted to press home that challenging what I feel is a form of violence, challenging state violence, is the responsibility of those who go through it. And ultimately, and there's a lot of work that has to be done in, you know, in this, but ultimately, we would like to see everyone in our community become an activist. Everyone in our community know what their rights are and challenge and document to create a different type of culture in our community.
Sunita?
The number of stop and frisks is on the rise, and we should take a stand against it. This kind of overly aggressive, illegal policing builds distrust and fear and resentment in the communities of color in the city and make it harder for the police to actually engage in real law enforcement rather than just harassment of the New York City citizens.
Why do you think this lawsuit is going to do better than the last one? The last one did well on the paper, but apparently there's still a rise in stop and frisks. So what are our expectations? I think it's what David is saying is you have to empower the community more. But what else can you say about this lawsuit versus the last one we won?
We think that we'll be able to obtain information about widespread practices in a way that's different. I think the other reason this lawsuit's different is that we have actually come forward and we're continuing to hold them accountable for the ongoing constitutional violations, and we really hope that we can hold them to task for the problems that community members are facing. And we really believe that this time there is public sentiment and a community momentum and hopefully political will to make the changes that are necessary.
Yeah, we certainly hope so. And, you know, it should be on the front page of the paper every day. It's not. I saw Bob Herbert had a column the other day about it. But there should be much more. So thank you, Sunita, and thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
We're delighted to have back with us award-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges. His new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, thoughtfully examines the erosion of American culture and levels a heavy criticism of it. One of Chris's theses is that the worse reality becomes around us, the less a beleaguered population wants to hear about it. So we distract ourselves with events related to celebrity breakdowns, gossip, and trivia. He says these are debauched revels of a dying culture.
Chris Hedges, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, Empire of Illusion. Let's first talk about the illusions, and then let's talk about his connection with the empire. The first two chapters, one is on, of all things, the World Wrestling Federation, and then the other on the porn industry. What's the point you're trying to make with wrestling and pornography?
I think the best way to see how illusioned we are as a culture is through the prism of popular entertainment. We're, of course, a completely pornified society. Estimates are that the porn industry makes 4 times the profits of that Hollywood makes. The largest users of porn on the internet are teenagers. And what are the messages that are being pumped out, either through World Federation Wrestling or through porn? That's why I dug deep within these spectacles. And I don't think I was misguided in attempting to dissect the structures of these powerful forms of entertainment. I mean, if you take wrestling, for instance, the whole narrative has changed. One from deep xenophobia, even racism. It was always the good American GI slaughter against the Iron Sheik or the Russian bear, to one of familial and social breakdown. One of the most popular characters on the circuit is a wrestler whose real name is Shawn Michaels. He goes by the wrestling name, the Heartbreak Kid, who's been wiped out by the economic meltdown and is now essentially enslaved to a rapacious capitalist manager who exploits and uses him.
This was great in the narrative. I mean, I want to encourage people to get this book.
Empire of Illusion.
Because that
Chris
kind of story,
Hedges.
You can't put it down when you read the narratives that have been created for these wrestlers compared to what we had before, and it illustrates the point you're about to say. But keep going, Chris, because I just want to say this is really, that story which I read was fabulous.
Well, that kind of stuff's all through it. I mean, and you look at what's happened with porn. Porn's not something I was particularly familiar with. It's not this sort of hazy, backlit, shaved bodies of the Playboy Channel anymore. It is violence, and it's not simulated violence. I interviewed the women who act on these sets, and they are black and blue when they're finished, without going into detail over the radio. I mean, they require surgical procedures frequently. They're popping painkillers before they go on the set. The first woman I interviewed, after a few minutes, having been a war correspondent, it was clear to me that she had post-traumatic stress disorder. And the violence that is done to these women in the name of eroticism is about turning women into commodities who no longer express any emotion other than the craven desire to fulfill the most disgusting needs and forms of humiliation that can be meted out by their partners in these pornographic films. And when you look at the stills from Abu Ghraib, they could be stills from a set of a porn film, and I don't think that's accidental. Right. I end the chapter with these guys who go in and buy these $7,500 silicone dolls, which are anatomically correct, and they take them home and have sex with them, because in the end, that's what porn is about, and deeply, that's what the commodity culture is about. It's about necrophilia. It's about killing people's souls and turning them into silicone objects.
Now, how does this all relate to the overall theme of literacy and illusion and reality, which is what we can get to the other chapters, but these two chapters in particular?
Well, the narrative by which we explain ourselves to ourselves is no longer print-based. We have just statistically staggering amounts of illiteracy. About 42 million people in this country are illiterate. Another roughly 50 million are semi-literate, meaning they read at about a fourth or fifth grade level. That's a third of our population. Coupled with huge numbers of people who are technically literate but don't read anymore. One figure I ran into was that 80% of American households did not buy a book last year. And the danger of that is that the images that we are very skillfully fed are done so by people who have profit-making agendas or agendas of power. I think if you look closely at the Obama campaign, you can see that Obama, in essence, was a brand. In the same way that if you look at Calvin Klein or Benetton a few years ago when they put up people of color on their billboards or HIV-positive models, and they got that notion of sort of risque style and progressive politics to be identified with the products that they were selling. It's not accidental that Obama's campaign was given by advertising agents the Marketer of the Year Award, beating out Nike, Zappos, Apple. And Obama has done what all brands do, and that's to make us confuse how we're made to feel with knowledge and to confuse a brand with an experience. and not see the underlying structures of the corporate state. So when you have a powerful dissemination of images, and we are a culture bombarded with images, a culture utterly awash in lies, rolling over the landscape, and people have unmoored themselves from print. You see it with the decline, heavy crisis within the publishing industry, the death of newspapers. What's really happening is that we are severing ourselves from a culture of verifiable fact and replacing it with a culture where lies become true, where opinions and facts are interchangeable. That's what can create the false reality of something like death panels. And that's exceedingly dangerous because, as the great philosophers on totalitarianism have understood, whether that's Hannah Arendt or Karl Popper or Fritz Stern, is that once you unmoor yourself from a fact-based universe, which is essentially print-based, then totalitarianism, which is built on propaganda and spectacle, takes over your information system. And there is no longer any debate between those people who retreat into a non-reality-based world and that dwindling minority of the rest of us who cling to the world of verifiable fact.
Is it your thesis that the more complex our sort of political situation and the external world becomes, that the more people need this kind of illusion and the less they read?
No, I think it's been a cultural shift which has had many factors, mostly corporate-driven. There's, of course, been a tremendous decline in public education. The whole ascendancy of standardized testing, which measures a very peculiar and deformed kind of intelligence and analytical intelligence. Lawrence Summers sort of, for me, manifests this. The youngest economics tenured professor at Harvard, who utterly lacks any common sense. He knows how to sustain a system, and that's what he did under the Clinton administration and what he's doing now by looting the U.S. Treasury and trashing the global economy. But they're not actual intellectuals. Intellectual thought by its nature is subversive. That's what Socrates tried to tell us, because it questions structures and assumptions. And that's not done. It's not done anymore, not even within most of our elite universities, some of which I have taught in and some of which I attended. And that's very frightening. I think that there has been a tremendous cultural, social, political transformation with the rise of the corporate state, with what Sheldon Wolin correctly calls our form of inverted totalitarianism. And that has quite consciously been designed to shut out the bottom two-thirds, at least, of the country, and create, in essence, what the end of the Roman Empire created, which was these vast spectacles and epic emotional tirades that we see on Fox and all the other cable news shows to consume or poison our political and civil discourse. And no one could be happier with the death of news. And, you know, I worked in a newspaper for many years, and I don't want to minimize its many deficiencies, but what newspapers did, in essence, were tell lies of omission. It's what they didn't tell, which is still ethically a lie. But at least what was in there was largely based on verifiable fact. Now that's all gone. And societies that become unrooted from a fact-based culture can't sustain themselves because they retreat into illusions, into collective self-delusion. And you can see that with the utter inability, both on the political leadership and the population at large, to confront the catastrophe we face with our environmental crisis and our economic crisis. We are all pretending that reality is not an impediment to what it is we want, that we can, and that's fed to us across the political spectrum, whether it's by Oprah or the Christian right or Tony Robbins and these self-help gurus or Hollywood, and that becomes very dangerous because the fact is the jobs that we have shedded, we are not coming back. We are entering a kind of a form of neo-feudalism. The environmental crisis is irreversible. It's just a question now of whether we can actually save the ecosystem on which we depend for life, and yet we're all pretending that it's not happening. And a dream is something you strive towards. An illusion is something you live in. as that gap opens up between that illusion of who we think we are and where we think we're going and the reality, it becomes very dangerous politically. Illusions allow people to remain in a state of childishness, infantilism. And when the wolf knocks on the door, when it's your house that is foreclosed, when you go bankrupt because you can't pay your medical bills, when you realize that your job is not only not coming back, but your children aren't going to get jobs which will provide lives of dignity and fulfillment, then you're unprepared, as children are, and you reach out and look for a demagogue or a savior who promises revenge and moral renewal and new glory. And that's not a new story. I watched it in Yugoslavia. The war in Yugoslavia was caused by the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia, not by ancient ethnic hatreds. It's what opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks with the collapse of Tsarist Russia. It's, of course, what, you know, it was Weimar Germany that vomited off the Nazis and Hitler. So it's exceedingly dangerous.
We've been talking with author Chris Hedges, who has written Empire of Illusion. Chris, let me jump ahead towards the end of the book, where you talk about subjects like imperialism and the real end of the democratic stage in this country and where we're heading. And you mentioned the word socialism. Talk to us about what you think an ideal society would look like as opposed to what we have now. Where do we want to go?
Well, we're all socialists now. It's just the only question is, who are we a socialist for? Is it Citibank and Goldman Sachs, or is it, you know, that poor former steel worker who's being tossed out of his house? Or the 40,000 Americans who died last year because they couldn't get proper medical care? I mean, the system has been so ethically perverted by corporations that we now sit by passively and allow our for-profit healthcare industry legally to hold sick children hostage while parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. What kind of a society is that? We permit capitalists to take control of our healthcare system and profit quite literally off of human suffering and death in the same way that our permanent war economy profits off of suffering and death. You know, I went to seminary, so I can't finally escape it. But I think in theological terms, you could argue that the engines of corporate power are about death, not about life, not about sustaining, nurturing, protecting life. That, as Carl Pugliani understood in his great book, The Great Transformation, when a society turns everything into a commodity, including human beings, including the natural world, then it allows forces within that society to exploit and exhaust both human beings and the natural world until they collapse. And such societies, in essence, cannibalize themselves until they die. And that's what we're doing, both economically and environmentally. What kind of a society I would like to see is wresting back the government from the hands of corporations, because these corporations, which are supranational, are literally hollowing out the nation from the inside. Largest deficits in human history, infrastructure collapsing, a creation of a vast permanent underclass. And Lawrence Summers has even talked about what he calls a jobless recovery, as if such a thing is possible. I love speaking in Canada because it always reminds me how narrow the spectrum of discussion is in the United States. I spoke at the University of Winnipeg and thought, of course, I was a great radical. And when I finished, the economics professor stood up and said that he wanted to make it clear to everyone in the audience that I was just what he called a radical Keynesian, not a real socialist. It turns out the economics department at the University of Winnipeg is Marxist. And that's probably true. I'm a Swedish socialist. I lived in France and Switzerland. And I don't think that a society with our resources has any excuse for urban, inner-city enclaves of severe deprivation or homeless people on the streets or people who are sick and have catastrophic illnesses and are thrown out like human refuse. It's pretty basic stuff. I covered conflicts, you know, wars for a long time, and I learned a lot from being around military units. And good military units never leave their wounded or dead on the battlefield, even at great risk to people within the unit. Now, it, you know, there's no, once somebody is dead, they're not worth anything in a commodity-driven culture. But units that took care of their own and sacrificed for their own always had the best morale and were the most effective. And I think that that analogy can be made to the society at large, that you build a healthy and a strong and a vibrant country by taking care of those people who momentarily or perhaps permanently fall by the wayside and can't take care of themselves.
We're speaking with Chris Hedges, author of The Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle. It's an eye-opener. You know, you read a lot of books about everything from post-9/11, The End of Empire, and all that stuff. But this book is something unique. It's very different than anything you've ever read. And so we really recommend it.
Well, no, I would say, Chris, that you put in this book what Heidi and Michael and I have been trying to get over the air for the last 5 years. And it's all between the covers of Empire of Illusion. It's just an excellent book. Right. And people should go out and read it.
We have to walk out of the mainstream. Don't fall for this, what Ralph Nader calls the least worst. We don't have much time left if we don't build powerful movements that stand for something. Then these corporate forces, which control both parties and, of course, are elected officials and have, in essence, carried out a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion, will quite literally kill us. And it is incumbent upon all of us who have a conscience, who care about what is left of our anemic democracy, not to take any crap anymore from the Democrats.
Chris Hedges, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. And again, Empire of Illusion, a wonderful, amazing, and book that you will learn a lot from, by Chris Hedges.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'd like to take a few minutes now to thank our affiliate stations around the country.
You know, we broadcast out of studios on Wall Street in New York City to the tri-state area on this tremendously powerful transmitter. But we've gotten other stations that carry our program from coast to coast and even in Alaska. And we wanted to mention them and thank all our listeners out there.
Well, we have WHYS, which is Eau Claire Community Radio 96.3 FM in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM.
And we also have KSOW in Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP in Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM. And KRFC, 88.9 FM, in Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT, 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD, 90.7 Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. We also have WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, in Northampton, Massachusetts.
And KEIF-FM at 104.7 in Enid, Oklahoma. And Fort Royal, Virginia is broadcasting our show at 1640 AM. And also in Asheville, North Carolina, WPVM, that's 103.5 FM.
ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago, Auckland, Atlanta, Boston, and Melbourne. Also, Moton Community House Radio, which is online, and WLRI in Gap, Pennsylvania.
And we have WPRR at 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS in Columbus, Ohio, which is a community radio station broadcasting to Central Ohio. And KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri.
We have Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for joining us, Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's our newest edition. And of course, as always, our local station WBAI New York City 99.5 FM. WPRR 1680 AM and 95.3 FM, Public Reality Radio in Grand Rapids, Michigan. WHUS 91.7, the University of Connecticut.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.